You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, philosophizing from Madison, Wisconsin.
Seth Paskin from Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allen in Boston, Massachusetts.
And this is Eric Douglas from across the sea in the United Kingdom. Not really a Brit, but trying his best.
You sound like half a Brit.
That's about it. Half a Brit. It means I'm from Canada, but it's a long story from there, and it takes a lot of eddies and turns, and I end up everywhere and grew up everywhere, and my accent got befuddled at a young age from going to too many schools and too many countries with too many languages.
So you already sounded like this during grad school. This is not a recent acquisition.
I was already profoundly corrupted by the time I got to graduate school, yes. So it's unique, if nothing else. Hopefully it's not too annoying.
Well, welcome, Eric, as our first guest panelist. We're going to have another one next time in the form of Mr. Dylan Casey, an actual physics guy, when we talk about physics. But the question for episode 12 is, what is wisdom? Focusing on the ancient Chinese Taoist philosopher Chuang Tzu, reading the text that bears his name. Specifically sections 2, 3, 18, and 19. And did you guys read 6 or not?
Define read. Yeah, sure.
Some of it.
Some
Didn't
of
say
six.
Understand, but read. Yeah, sure.
6 is very long. There are a few salient points in it that I wanted made. But I guess in general, I glide over parts of this and brilliant things float to the surface. And some of them, you just look at it and you move on. Here are the ground rules we've been giving ourselves for these discussions. We try not to assume that our audience knows anything about any of this. No gratuitous name dropping. We're interested in ideas, not with fetishizing a bunch of dead philosophers, or living philosophers for that matter. If we have a point to make, we'll just make it and not say, for instance, you would know what I'm talking about if you had read St. Augustine's 1,000 Women I Have Schtupped. The Schtupped is just a loose translation of the Latin. We shall be rigorous and exact in all that we say, except in the case where not doing so seems like it would be more entertaining. All right, so the Chuang Tzu, just a little historical background. So he's around, let me look at my timeline in this paper version I have of the Chuang Tzu's basic writings translated by Burton Watson, which is the same translator as the online thing we linked to, but this only has 11 books in it. In any case, it has a really good introduction. It explains that 551 to 233 BC is the period of 100 philosophers, including Confucius, Mo Tzu, Lao Tzu, Mencius, and Chuang Tzu, and many others. And that's far enough ago, and the historical records are crummy enough, so it's pretty much just like, you know, somebody's text referring to somebody else, and then somebody else's text referring to this other person, and in a lot of cases, you don't even know if, like, how good this reference is, like, what are they basing this on? So we're not really sure of the chronology of that. So supposedly, we think that Chuang Tzu was written by a guy named Chuang Tzu, but maybe not. Maybe there wasn't even a person named Chuang Tzu, right?
He was actually a butterfly.
Or was the butterfly him?
Yes.
We'll find out. Stay tuned.
When this Taoist stuff was originally being expounded, there were several other big schools of Chinese philosophy going at the time. The most famous of them, Confucianism, which is the one that stuck around afterward. But there are other ones that focused on logic that Chuang Tzu makes fun of. Confucianism in particular, how would you characterize Confucianism? Like, it's pretty uptight, right?
Bureaucratic efficiency, right?
Yeah, well, it eventually became the state religion. So Chuang Tzu is writing in reaction to all these other schools of ancient Chinese philosophy, all of which are more uptight than he was, than the Taoists. And he's considered the second of the great Taoists, Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu, but again, that's really just because Chuang Tzu refers to Lao Tzu as at least a character, somebody he quotes in his writing, and Lao Tzu does not refer to Chuang Tzu. That's the only evidence that we have of that chronology. In fact, the Chuang Tzu could have been written by a bunch of different people and been pieced together. So that's about the same time as Plato, right? About 300 BC?
Yeah.
That sounds like what I know, too.
Yep. Yeah. Well, into the text. So what did people think?
Shouldn't be thinking. just to throw it out in terms of the background,
yep.
I just wonder if I could just make a couple comments. That's
why you're here.
Okay. All right. Well, one thing is that Chuang Tzu, from what I understand, didn't recognize himself. If he was a particular person who wrote maybe the first 6 chapters of the book, which maybe he did, and the rest were other people you know, filling in commentary. He didn't regard himself as a Taoist per se. And, you know, these terms, when we talk about the school of Taoism amongst the 100 schools or the 100 flowers that they let bloom at that time, of course, they didn't have these names and titles. But otherwise, it's probably pretty comparable to Athens in Greece, both in terms of sort of the concentration of different philosophers, different schools and thoughts. And it was a very rich time. It's very strange that it should have happened at the same time as Greece and Athens. And then we have about 200 years there where it just seems like an enormous amount of philosophy just was produced out of nowhere. It's a really remarkable time. And of course, then to really get a handle on any one of these people, we would need to have some context of the whole background, which we probably can't have and can't do. But it would be the same as if we were going to try and, what was that, Aristotle or Plato, or I guess that's not name dropping to name them, is it? I'm not sure. But, you know, I mean,
I think people will know who Plato and Aristotle are.
Okay, so that's fair game now. Plato and the rest is footnotes. Okay. So then in that case, you know, anyways, I just want to sort of say this, that it's going to be a little bit difficult to try and talk about some of this without having some sense of that larger context and background. But it's probably pretty comparable to Athens, I think. I could go on. I just don't want to. I'm not sure how much.
Oh, very time nice.
Take. All right.
So, should we wade into the text, or do people have some overall reactions? Had you read any of this before, Wes?
No, I hadn't. This is the first. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot, actually. I don't know what I have to say about it, but I enjoyed it.
What about you, Seth?
This is a first for me as well. I seem to recall at various points in my life, I'll say, having certain Zen encounters or encounters with Zen texts or Zen concepts, which this reminded me of. But what I thought was interesting was how I just was not able to get out of my sort of Western way, I guess, of thinking about this, and kept looking for parallels to people we've already covered or thinkers. And of course, found a bunch of stuff about Heidegger in there, so take that for what it's worth. But we can get to that later.
So I'd read most of this in a Great Books of the Far East class in undergrad, so I wasn't even in a philosophy context. And I wanted to do some Taoism. We got some requests to do some non-Western stuff, and I read through the Tao Te Ching, the Lao Tzu one, which is, again, the possibly earlier and maybe more foundational text, and had a really hard time finding any assertions in there for us to discuss, as opposed to just, what does this mean? Like, we could spend the whole time just going through it line by line. What could that possibly mean? But it came off more like what you would imagine a religious text being, which is hard to do a philosophical evaluation of. Here, at least, though there is some of that, there seem to be some ideas that I at least could get more of a handle on. Things about truth, about the relation of language to facts. Certainly his ethics, insofar as there's an ethics presented here, maybe we should say approach to ethics. I can see a lot of parallels to the way Nietzsche talked about it, that we talked about in the last episode, where it's kind of hard to figure out sort of what the positive thing is, but, you know, there are a lot of very distinct negative things, and especially kind of the more you read, even if one passage is confusing, there are themes that bubble up that you can get a general sense of what kind of life is being recommended.
It's a really interesting theme. I think maybe it's worth kind of looking at for a moment. The relationship of philosophy and theology, or mysticism or spirituality, or you can give these various names to that sort of compartment of stuff. And I guess it does really seem different to me. I mean, before I sort of studied Western philosophy, I did spend some time with some of this stuff in another time in my life. But there's something about it, it's a little different than the way if you read maybe Augustine or, you know, these Western, obviously very theological philosophers. And to some extent, you're kind of confronted with this whole question about the existence and nature of God and what we might be able to say about that and so on. But you can kind of divorce those questions, at least we've learned to do it in the West, it seems, and sort of just concentrate on the so-called philosophy part and talk about metaphysics or whatever. And it is a sense in which I feel that when looking at these texts, especially a Taoist text, less so the Confucianist texts or the Maoist texts or these other schools in the East, but especially the Taoist text, there's no getting away from the fact that to do Taoist philosophy, and I put little quotes around that, is also to engage in Taoist spirituality, Taoist theology, Taoist mysticism, that you probably can't finally separate these themes when looking at either Chuang Tzu or Lao Tzu or any of these texts to make any sense of what they mean.
I read a lot on mysticism at some point in sort of early undergrad and was interested in it as a potentially different avenue of getting knowledge. That is, that I read a couple things that said, you know, there's this mystical experience that even though it's described in different ways by different religions, it seems to be like a specific psychological experience that a lot of folks are referring to from different traditions. So maybe there's some, oh, maybe I should check this out and experience my oneness with the cosmos and that kind of stuff. I didn't see, I mean, you could say that some of the crazy stuff that is said in Chuang Tzu maybe is as a result of having this mystical experience, but it doesn't seem like that's the focus. It's not, you know, just go fast and put yourself in these extreme physiological situations until you have this experience of God, and then you have an insight that nobody else has. Do you see that in here, or is... do you need that even to get what the philosophy is here?
I guess I do. I mean, I do see the references here. There are references to Taoist alchemy. For example, this is a line from section 2, say about 9 paragraphs from the top. Quick look. The 100 joints, the 9 openings, the 6 organs all come together and exist here as my body. And that reference there, for example, I mean, there's a philosophical point being made about what are the relations between the parts and the whole, you know, what's the boss part, what is the sort of defining part. But in addition, I mean, this is a reference to a whole pile of kind of alchemical and medical texts and stuff. And maybe this is also kind of a background thing on this Taoism thing that, I mean, the Tao means the way, but before that was even really discussed as the way, you know, the scholarly tradition had many ways, you know, medical sciences, all these different sciences. And then there was an attempt
to
bring
these... call it the Tao? Did they use the same Chinese word?
I think the word means way. So yeah, right. It's like, you know, they had the Tao of this and the Tao of that and the Tao of D and the Tao of Da and so on like that. And it's like, oh, but what about, you know, the really big Tao that pulls this all together? You know, in fact, the emphasis on methodology, like the sciences, it's almost like saying Taoism is like the sciences or something, you know, akin to that. This is sort of a really kind of good background thing. I'm sounding like I know what I'm talking about. Let me assure you that I at best one quarter know what I'm talking about. But anyway, but I probably say it because I have actually made this mistake in the past where I then was engaging with people who actually did kind of know what they were talking about, and I was interpreting texts in a certain way, and then I'd point out something and say, oh, well, you see, these metaphors, in a way, actually have literary significance, you know, really major literary significance to some other collection of texts or thinking or thought and so on like that. And we're going to miss all this, you know, for the most part, but maybe
except
it helps just
so
to be aware
we
that
have,
we know is there. Oh, sorry.
We have some nice footnotes, at least in my written version. I know there are numbers in the online version. Are they actually clickable? Did you anybody look at the footnotes?
I tried. I failed.
No, I had to print it out and read it on the plane.
No footnotes for me.
Yeah, I didn't find the footnotes. I mean, they're not clickable and I didn't find them. So, I mean, great. Super.
The man of footnotes cannot be a sage.
That's right. What are footnotes doing in Taoist text here? We don't need footnotes. Fuck the footnotes.
A couple things. So one is, I think you sold me a bill of goods because I think you actually said this was going to be about wisdom and you already started off with religion and spirituality and all that. But this seems to me to be a particularly difficult reading to just jump into precisely for the reasons that Eric just sort of indirectly cited, namely that it feels like there's a tremendous amount of context around this that would be useful to have. And at the same time, I suppose, given that there are many places in the text where they tell stories that I assume are meant to be instructional, I'm not sure what the right term is, not allegorical, but you know, you tell the story about so-and-so being at a funeral and acting inappropriately. And then everybody says, oh, well, why is he acting inappropriately? And the wise person says, what are you talking about? He's doing exactly the appropriate thing. And you're supposed to say, oh, well, I guess I should question my concept of appropriateness.
Would that be a homily?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know what a homily is.
Me neither. Remind us, please.
Don't they call them, like in Zen, the koans, like what is the sound of one hand clapping where you're supposed to say, oh gosh, that's confusing, and yet it's supposed to spur thought.
A lecture or discourse on a moral theme. That's a homily.
Well,
that's not really a story.
Yeah,
anyway.
There's a lot of things that I can say about my experience reading the text, but they're very piecemeal. So I'm hoping that they will come up and there will be some coherence that gets brought to them at some point. The one thing I can say is this, and then I will shut up for the time being. I predicted that there would be a line in here that said something like, the way that can be shown is not the true way. before it happened. So I felt pretty proud of myself on that point.
I think that's maybe a really good starting point in terms of actually getting into the meat of the text, because this is, at least from what I've seen, one of the most important concepts of Taoism as opposed to any of the other Chinese schools, and maybe almost any of the Western philosophical traditions. Can I make a little reference? Are little references okay if I'm...
Please go ahead.
I mean, I'm such a lame philosopher. I use
you just have to explain what
like
you're
that.
Talking about. That's
okay,
all.
Well,
you
all
can
right.
refer I'm, to something as long as you say what it means as right. opposed to just referring to it and moving on.
Well, you know, Cambridge has this little encyclopedia of philosophy, and you can look up, you know, all kinds of terms and get a quick overview of things. And they refer to philosophical Taoism in a very interesting way. And it bears on a lot of the metaphysics that we do in the West. But Taoism takes the position that there really is a metaphysical reality. So they're realists on one hand, but they're very different in that they are semantic anti-realists, so that they do not regard the ultimate truth of the universe as something that can be explicitly uttered. And this creates, I think, a really interesting position that I haven't seen really explicitly laid out anywhere else, where on the one hand, you know, they thus try to do philosophy in the interest of coming closer to the truth, but full on recognizing that every attempt that they do to do this with words, with language, will necessarily fail. And that line, it does show up, and I also noted it, and it's also famously the first line of the Tao Te Ching, which is, I guess, probably the one. I mean, it's really remarkable if you think about this from the point of view as a religious text. You know, the very first line says, you know, the Tao of which we speak is not the true Tao. In other words, everything that we're going to say now is not really the truth. It's rather modest, remarkable, you know.
Yeah.
This struck me as a very, very profound point about Taoism and an extremely important point of maybe of departure for understanding anything that's going on here, that the relationship of what the enterprise of doing, say, philosophy and what it is you're trying to talk about, and appreciating the enormous gulf between them in a way. Anyway, let me just stop.
So
on that.
Is he just being a kind?
No, he's being Wittgensteinian.
I agree. More. Well, that's got to be name dropping. Wait a second.
We're referring to past
episodes.
Yes, past
I'm referring to a past episode,
Because. Because for Wes, at least, everybody's some version of Kant, right? Unless they're just wrong. Everybody who's right is some version.
Oh, that's good. I can have to think about that one.
Huh. In that, there's a certain sphere that is beyond, well, explicitly, examination by rationality and science.
Well, I think this is, in this case, I think it's just a form of ultimate skepticism, right?
Right, that seems to be the focus of a lot of this chapter two here. I had to skip over chapter one because chapter one just seemed to be a lot of metaphors to say, this wisdom is so cool, it's so much cooler than you could understand. And then and that's like the whole thing. So let's just skip straight to number two where some of the actual ideas are given.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and take a novice stab at some of that stuff that's in section two, kind of the first part around language. So sticking with this theme of language, it seemed to me that one of the messages was, if you're focusing on things and the way things relate to each other and the way things are different from each other, you're missing the point. And that the suggestion was that language really is a tool that enables differentiation. There's a point in there where this translation anyway uses the word attribute. If you focus on attributes and...
To use an attribute to show that attributes are not attributes?
Yes, and he talks about a state in which this and that and truth and falsehood isn't a thing that's true also false, isn't a thing that's this also that. The implication was, from my perspective, that language was basically designed to separate the world into this and that, true and false, and give things names and attributes and functions, and that the first message of the text is, you need to forget that.
I'll just read the quote. So the section is called Discussion on Making All Things Equal, just for the listeners. And I think it starts a couple paragraphs earlier. Right. Words are not just wind. Words have something to say. But if what they have to say is not fixed, then do they really say something or do they say nothing? People suppose that words are different from the peeps of baby birds, but is there any difference or isn't there? What does the way rely upon that we have true and false? What do words rely upon that we have right and wrong? How can the way go away and not exist? How can words exist and not be acceptable? When the way relies on little accomplishments and words rely on vain show, then we have the rights and wrongs of the Confucians and the Moists. What one calls right, the other calls wrong. What one calls wrong, the other calls right. But if we want to right their wrongs and wrong their rights, then the best thing to use is clarity. Everything has its this, everything has its that. From the point of view of that, you cannot see it. But through understanding, you can know it. So I say that comes out of this, and this depends on that, which is to say this and that give birth to each other. That's probably enough for now. It goes on for another three pages like that.
Good choice of passage.
Is that a Fresh Prince song?
Jeez, Fresh Prince. You going into the
parents
you
just don't understand
West for this reference.
Parents just don't understand the way. I just like the peeps of baby
so
parents.
Could you guys understand if I interpret that as saying if you spend your time thinking about this differs from that and this causes that, but not realizing that actually this is the same as that and this cause and effect relationships are a mirage. That's what I was reading into this.
So why is it a mirage, though?
Look, I don't know. It's not really even stating it. It's just kind of throwing out a bunch of questions, right?
I would challenge a slight mirage, I think, is the wrong word. And this is a, sort of, in a way, I mean, again, this is, I mean, I'm just putting this out there, but it's not so much that words are false, but that they don't tell the whole story. And they're kind of a perspective. And there's a lot of relativism in Taoism that will come up again and again and again. So to see the relationship between this and that and what the words are that are doing this distinguishing and stuff is not to tell the whole story. And not to tell the whole story is not to see clearly sort of the whole picture. And I think that's where this reference to clarity comes in, that there's a meta level which is non-linguistic. And maybe if you can see things from that perspective, you know, it clarifies a lot of this. But if you stay stuck on the level of words and semantics, you will not be able to really come very far, you know, on the way. I mean, but the idea is not so much that it's a mirage, because it's very practical, you know, purpose to language and what we say with it, but that it's not final and it's not complete.
So it's easy to see, like, from that passage, he's specifically ripping on the Confucians and the Moists and these people that set up detailed rules of logic and rules of ethics. So for the Confucians in particular, there's just a right way to do everything. Even ethics and aesthetics all ran into each other. So it looks to here like just a flat out rejection of that kind of thing, that that's all shallow. But then in the intro to this paper version that Burton Watson wrote, he was saying historically, these really haven't been so exclusionary, that even though Confucianism became the state religion, a lot of times the same people that would teach or follow Confucianism throughout their public life, right? So it would have instructions on, you know, respecting your elders and doing well in your job and that kind of stuff. In their private lives would study Taoism because, well, it's kind of just keeping things in perspective. All these, you know, individual truths, these small truths that you need to accomplish specific things are fine and good, but that, as you say, is not the whole story. That to be a spiritual person requires more than that. So are we done? Is that... That's all there is.
I got fixated on the idea that he was basically saying truth and falsity are illusions, or at least isn't something that's true can also be false. Like, it sounded to me like it went beyond, Eric, what you were saying, that it's a useful thing, but it's an obfuscation. Language obscures the true way from us. Not to say that it's not a necessary component of human life, because you can't buy grain at the market without language and some concept of weight and the way of dealing with people, but that you sort of have to abandon it in order to get to whatever this way is that's sort of beyond truth and falsity, or is truth with a capital T.
Oh, so that's an interesting question. You know, does language actually, not only is it not useful, but it's in fact negatively useful, and that it obscures the truth, which is quite a strong thing to say. I don't get the sense of that they take a stand quite that strong. And especially given how wordy they are, you know, I mean, just look at this text, you know, I mean, what the hell is he talking about then? You know, I mean,
it's a good point. You know, if they took that stance, like, there would be no reason to write anything down. That's true.
Right. Who does that in the West? Who takes that position? It must be somebody.
Well, Socrates never wrote anything down.
Well, there is that, I guess, really, right. So you have kind of this sort of sophist element or something.
Wes had sent Seth and me an article about Derrida. That sounds like that. It was actually a criticism of Derrida by Searle, a Western philosopher, who was saying that at least this guy who was writing about Derrida was like a book review of a review of Derrida, if that's not confusing enough. Derrida being a modern French postmodernist philosopher, a 20th century guy, that was saying that Derrida was claiming what sounds very much like this here. It's the this and that give birth to each other, so seeming opposites are not. Where there's birth, there must be death. Where there's death, there must be birth. Where there's acceptability, there must be unacceptability, blah, blah, blah. Therefore, the sage does not proceed in such a way, but illuminates all in the light of heaven. That these seeming opposites, we have to make them equal in some important way if we're to have wisdom. Is that like a part of postmodernism, as far as you guys know what that is?
Okay, now I get what you're saying. So I think there might be a slight distinction there, Mark, in that I think that the deconstructionists and the postmodernists just basically would say that the opposites require each other. And that the fact that you can't have one without the other negates the priority that one takes over the other. So we say that good is better than evil, but the reality is good and evil are opposites that require each other, and you cannot prioritize good over evil. So the whole structure that's built around their opposition falls apart. This to me sounds like it's saying, it's not saying the priority of one over the other, but more that a thing can be seen in such a way where it is a this or a that, where it's true or it's false. And it's the fact that, you know, getting to the point about, there's a number of passages in here about the perception of fish and animals, you know, like the fish don't find the two beautiful women beautiful. From the fish's perspective, beauty is something completely different, if there is such a thing as beauty in a fish's conception at all. And I think what they're trying to say is not so much that we need to deconstruct the idea of beauty because it's really requires the idea of ugliness, and that we've just arbitrarily said that beauty was more important than ugliness. It's more like saying your concept of beauty as a human being is completely irrelevant to a leech or a monkey, but a leech or monkey are all part of the order of things, and they have just as much right to be considered, and they're just as much a part of things as you are. So you need to kind of think about the fact that you just have this completely arbitrary perception that's a product of your circumstance that other things in the world could care less about.
But I've been constructing a Leech Fashions website. Is that not?
LeechDuds.com.
I guess I see. Yes. So in some ways, it's a simple statement of relativism, which is a direct response to the Confucians that are so concerned of, you know, correctness in all sorts of things and correctness in artistic forms. But I guess I do also see, specifically since it mentioned where there is birth, there must be death, where there is death, there must be birth. And the discussion of death throughout this, I guess there's a couple that I don't want to completely derail the conversation to that, because that's a whole chunk. But you know, he definitely has the kind of, well, we have no reason to be afraid of death, right? That's just part of the natural progression of things. And so the nature that we should accept as a whole, you know, involves both of those things. So therefore, ultimately, the opposition between them is only illusory. They are sides of the same coin, in the same way that, you know, it seems like that you were saying the deconstructionists would say. Maybe you don't realize that through analysis.
One thing, though, and this is, again, would be the distinction that I was sort of trying to make earlier, that they adopt a relativist position so far as semantics are concerned, but not where metaphysics comes into the picture. And that's a large divergence from most sort of postmodernist thinking. In other words, they still maintain underlying it as, you know, really something it's you can only say is akin to a belief in God, a belief in the Tao, that there is an ultimateness and a way that that ultimateness is, and that ultimateness has real qualities that really are so and not so, but we can't say it, but nevertheless it is so.
Yeah, I think what you just described there is a skepticism rather than relativism. There is a way that things are, but the thing that's called hopeless over and over again in this text is being able to discriminate, right?
We've got two words we're throwing out there, relativism and skepticism. I mean, what's the difference between those two for you? So
relativism makes the claim that there is no way that things are, there is no distinction between truth and falsity, or man is the measure of all things, is the classical description of that. And then skepticism says there is a way things are, it's just that we don't have access to that, and we cannot ever fully know.
Okay, now I understand your use of skepticism. Okay, fair enough.
Sorry, yeah, so the way I saw, yeah, so I thought you were describing them more as skeptics and less as relativists. And I think that captures your distinction between, you could call it semantic relativism and then metaphysical realism, but it would come down to the same
thing. Well, part of it, this relativism, I like to refer to as like indexicality, just to throw out an obnoxious word, which is that this is kind of like Nietzsche was, that there are objective relations between people's natures and what is maybe beneficial for them. It's just that that's not the same for every person. So it's not that it's, you know, it's all relative. That is, if I say it's good for Seth to sleep under a tree on rocks, and when I say that, it's true, but when Wes says that, it's false or something. Like, no, we're talking about the same thing, about a relationship between Seth and the sleeping on rocks. I say that because this is like given in the next paragraph here. This is an actual example that's given. So there are objective things that are in accord with fish nature, in accord with person nature. And it's actually not so clear to the extent to which he thinks people are similar. Like in some places, he seems to think that, I would argue certainly that there's commonalities in human nature that makes us distinct in rule-like ways from fish. But in some other sections, he even like doubts, for instance, if you're trying to teach spirituality, like if people, whether by nature or just the state of mind that they happen to have over their life, or, you know, whether it's changeable or not, I'm not sure, but people are in very different states of receptivity, and so different teachings are going to be appropriate to different people. And he makes that kind of point about a lot of other things as well, like what kind of dietary regimen, what kind of things are really appropriate to your nature, are a matter of your specific nature, not something that you could generalize about the whole human race. So there's nothing relativist, right? That just means relativist is something more radical. It's not just saying different things are appropriate for different people.
Right. So when the language is ambiguous, right? So with the fish and their perception of beauty, for instance, it's, the punchline to that is, the way I see it, the rules of benevolence and righteousness and the paths of right and wrong are all hopelessly snarled and jumbled. How could I know anything about such discriminations? So there it seems there's the lack of knowledge about such discriminations. They're beyond human knowledge, but there's also this assertion about things being hopelessly snarled and jumbled. And you could say, well, that's a matter of complexity, or you could say that that's kind of verging on relativism, where there is no way things are.
Is it virtue as pursued by Confucians and stuff like that that's hopelessly snarled and jumbled? Or does that include virtue as pursued by Taoists?
Well, when we say virtue now, we're...
I don't know what you mean by that. You're saying this is a relational thing, too?
Okay, this is just something that I got out of, again, this introduction by Burton Watson, that he uses the word virtue, or te, sometimes because he's using it as the Confucians or something. Because Confucians are really concerned with what is the virtuous action in all cases. And they even, in fact, again, use the word the way, you know, the Tao, for following their way. So sometimes he's dismissing the term of virtue, that in some ways, that's just illusory. You're worrying about a lot of minute that just doesn't matter. And even if you think you're a sage in the Confucian sense, you could still be a pitifully confused, hopeless, pathetic individual, according to the Taoist. On the other hand, if you throw away all that kind of intellectual, analytical way of figuring out what virtue is and trying to adhere yourself artificially to it, right? You've got this external list of rules that you are trying to apply yourself to. If you instead sit back and are less active about it and listen to your inner voices or something like that, then you will pursue the way, you'll have virtue in the Taoist sense. And it's not unknowable. I mean, it might be really hard to know. And you might have to go through weird regimens to figure it out. And you can't write it down. You can't speak it. You can't teach it to somebody in a way that they'll be able to just follow you by hearing it, in the way that a Confucian can write down, here are the rules to follow. But it's not hopelessly jumbled in itself.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of second something along those lines. I guess I am a little uncomfortable with the use of the term skepticism because of that, because it's an epistemological notion, and the Taoist, I don't think, really makes this claim that these things aren't knowable. Contrary, they do think this stuff is knowable, but it's more akin to the problems are one of what tools do you use for what sort of activity, and you have to use the right tools for the right job, and not one that the job can't be done, or that one can't know how these things are.
Wes, there's
it's not clear from the text, seems to imply a lot of lack of knowledge.
There's no doubt that there's an assertion that there's such a thing as a sage.
Right, they talk about it all the time.
A sage who knows, who's right with the ways of heaven, or lives according to the ways of heaven, or whatever that is. There's somebody out there who gets it.
Heaven being the equivalent of nature. It's the same. That's the way he's using the word.
Okay.
Just so you know.
So it's definitely possible to know whatever it is that there is to know that's important.
Well, but, you know, there's a sense in which the skeptic has a notion of a sage, too, because the sage just is the skeptic, right? Socrates is a skeptic. He knows that he doesn't know. And there's a lot of that type of language in this, the idea of letting go. You know, the way involves a lot of sort of letting go of any analysis, letting go of discriminations, for instance. So it's a question of what type of knowledge we're talking about, I suppose. And this focus on doing and the focus on the being of a particular sage gets us away. It's a matter of making a distinction between different kinds of knowing, I think.
Yeah, I'd like to jump on that point with you, go follow that up, Wes, because as I'm thinking about this comparison of sort of Taoism with Socrates and his style, it's the sophist maybe generally, but Socrates in any case, and that there's one very important difference, and that is that Socrates is almost always engaged in a negative dialogue, and the Taoists alternate between negative and positive dialogue, so they continue to make positive assertions. And it seems to me that that is a difference worth noting here, and a difference between, you know, this sort of sophist skeptic as opposed to the Taoist. But yet saying that at the same time, I mean, you really have a point, because I just read this passage out. The true man of ancient times knew nothing of loving life, knew nothing of hating death. He emerged without delight. He went back in without a fuss. There's this notion of the great uncarved block of naive and innocent ignorance, of simplicity, and this is a recurrent theme. And so there's certainly something very comparably strong here in those two.
And just to give an illustration to that, a secondary source that I took a look at because I had read this when I was younger, it was a book from the 80s by Benjamin Hoff called The Tao of Poo.
Sure.
Bring it on.
Had you read that, Seth? I know Eric had, or seen that.
I've seen it. I don't recall that I ever read it, okay. But I remember when it came out because they also had the Day of Piglet.
Yes, yes. So it just gives parallels to the whole thing with the Taoist sage as somebody who just never gains any intellectual knowledge, but just goes around kind of having a good, relaxed time as being very much like Winnie the Pooh.
Yes, but Winnie the Pooh makes all kinds of statements too. You know, he doesn't just go around just kind of like hanging. He's always saying things like, well, I can't even think of an example.
Can't
right
quote
now,
Pooh?
I cannot quote the Pooh.
Well, yes, I did notice, actually having read the Pooh books to my kids not that long ago, that one of the jokes that is played in there is they get all their information from a kid, from Christopher Robin. So if Christopher Robin says something about heffalumps or something, some mistaken animal that doesn't really exist, but they'll then sort of follow that as gospel or trying to figure out what that might mean and pretend to know things that they don't know. So in fact, they're kind of acting like the people that Chuang Tzu makes fun of, that pretend to have this knowledge and act on it. And then, of course, their ignorance leads them to hilarious circumstances.
Right. But in the end, Pooh is always the one who just sort of, you turn the corner and he's just sitting there eating honey. Like, he doesn't buy into the whole thing. And he's just like, time to eat.
Well, you know, though, one of the things I think it might be informing my perspective on this a bit is having read another book, which was sometimes regarded as the third most important Taoist collection. In English, it was translated as The Tao of Politics and was written a couple hundred years later than Chuang Tzu and the Tao Te Ching. But one of the things that was very interesting about this is that history had a very important role to play in the way that Taoism developed. And at the historical times that the Tao Te Ching and Chuang Tzu were written, China was just coming out of a period of having had a relatively stable empire and falling into a period which I think they call the Warring States period, where things sort of really broke down. And there was, you know, on the one hand, you had development of all these new ideas happen as this breakdown happened. But on the other, life was pretty rough. And there were different reactions to that, these sort of political and economic difficulties of the time. And you had the Confucians trying to retain structure and tradition. And to some extent, the Taoists at least have been sort of pigeonholed maybe to saying, well, fuck society, go off into nature. Nature's got it right. We human beings have just, you know, we're just a mess. We're at war all the time. It's just pain and disaster. So just go and look at nature, you know, and if that means literally leave the cities and go live out in the country in some monastery or cave or something like that. But what happened then later, and this is why I bring this point up, is that when this later book was written, It was a return to times that were more cohesive and structure was returning and the different kingdoms were coming together and integrating and stability was returning. And at that point, it looks like, you know, this is, as I say, what is commonly regarded as the third most important Taoist text, is a text that becomes eminently practical in terms of how to actually govern. And I say all this because this says, you know, well, there are many sides to what Taoism was doing, and we don't want to look too limited just at what it was doing at this time and place.
So there are parts in the Chuang Tzu where he talks about politics, and for the most part, it's stay out of politics, right? That it'll just chew you up and spit you out. But they also say things like, this is not in any of the sections that were on the short list of ones that we were supposed to have read here, but the successful Taoist emperor, the leader that would follow Taoist principles, his country would just magically thrive. If you're so hands-on, then you're going to mess things up. But somehow, if you govern in accordance with the way, then everything's going to just be wonderful. And it's very unhelpful. And it's typical of a lot of the discussion of the sage in here, where the sage is going to be basically immortal. The sage is going to have this massive success without even trying. The sage is going to, like, how much of this is metaphorical? Or how much is just, you know, maybe this is pointing to the sage as kind of like Nietzsche's Obermensch or something, that it's not a real possibility. It's an ideal to shoot for. At least it makes it look like it's an objective. Like, you could recognize one of these people when you see them because they're so together and successful in every possible non-Confucian sense.
I don't know. I got the sense that there could be sages that were successful and sages that were completely unsuccessful, that it was really about how they understood or dealt with whatever it was that heaven had in store for them. It cares not about life, cares not about death, takes whatever comes as it comes. And if it's good, great, you know, delights, if it's something that can be delighted in, and doesn't despair if it's not. I didn't get the sense that there was an overman kind of theme going with the sages.
On the other hand, though, there is a long tradition of what are called the immortals. And I think that I would take them at their word that when they say it's possible to manifestly become one of these people that is immortal, they mean it. And there's a huge number of texts on how to do it. And it is really a major, major theme throughout a lot of these Taoist texts. I would really not take it as a metaphor. It would be one of the cases where I'd say they mean really seriously. Immortality is possible. You can achieve it if you get in touch with heaven and earth and the way the energies, the chis, bounce around between the two of them. And you can acquire the clarity of how this stuff works and begin to work with it. You can have really pretty much absolute power.
I love when
when
chis bounces around. I love that.
When cheese bounce around. I like cheese. Hey.
it's definitely not consistent. And the ones I find more helpful are the ones, Seth, that you're referring to, where it's just talking about the sage as a state of mind, as opposed to some other places in the text where it's like, once you stop trying, you'll succeed. Like, well, that's really annoying advice.
Karate Kid, right?
Yeah. The non-action or inaction is... The stuff about inaction.
We should look at that inaction, what they mean by that.
Wu Wei is the technical Chinese term. Wu Wei, is that right?
Ooh, go. You got it.
Definitely in talking about virtue, you know, they focus on the less you do, the better. In fact, from the Tao Te Ching, one of the oft-repeated sayings for me as an undergrad was, try to do less every day until you do nothing. I thought that was a good way to excuse my own laziness.
Found a section where it talks about inaction.
Read it.
It's in section 18. I take inaction to be true happiness, but ordinary people think it is a bitter thing. I say, perfect happiness knows no happiness, perfect praise knows no praise. The world can't decide what is right and what is wrong, and yet inaction can decide this. Perfect happiness, keeping alive, only inaction gets you close to this. I put a big question mark next to that one.
Well, keeping alive, so you're out of danger. If you don't do anything, nothing ventured, everything gained. Right?
Yeah,
don't even try.
Hold on. Here's the next paragraph, which kind of puts it in a different spin. Let me try putting it this way. The inaction of heaven is its purity. The inaction of earth is its peace. So the two inactions combine and all things are transformed and brought to birth. Wonderfully, mysteriously, there is no place they come out of. Mysteriously, wonderfully, they have no sign. Each thing minds its business and all grows up out of inaction. So I say, heaven and earth do nothing, and there is nothing that is not done. Among men, who can get hold of this inaction? I'm going to go back to that sentence. The inaction of heaven is its purity. The inaction of earth is its peace. It's an interesting turn of phrase that definitely suggests a view that maybe action has a sense of agency about it. So when you say the inaction of earth is its peace, the implication is that the world turns, but it doesn't do so with volition or intent or purpose. It simply does. And in that way, that's the kind of inaction that's being described here. An alternative interpretation, which gets me to Heidegger, which of course is always the end goal of any conversation that I have. It says, so the two inactions combine and all things are transformed and brought to birth. So it's a concept of generation from non-being or out of nothingness. And there's another place earlier where it talks about being and non-being. And this is a concept that I think is really, really interesting. I just am trying to understand how it's being employed in this context. Because there's a sense in which before you are born, in fact, before you're even conceived, the you as a you, there is no you. And then you are generated out of non-being into being. And then, of course, death takes you back into non-being. Maybe. In a way, maybe. So there's a certain kind of mystery about this generation of being out of non-being that I think plays into this. And I kind of read this as saying, inaction is really getting to the place where you allow something to come out of nothing.
Yeah.
And I realized that that does not make any sense, but that's just kind of where I ended up.
I hadn't read that as metaphysical, so that's interesting. I mean, it's hard to get, he doesn't separate out this the psychological and the cosmological so much in here, right? Maybe because of the skepticism that when you talk about existence, what you're really talking about is people's attitudes towards existence. So like in the Tao of Pooh, nothingness was read strictly, well, because there are passages that talk about it specifically as nothingness of the mind. And, you know, part of the sage is getting yourself in a state of nothingness. In other words, if you empty your mind of all the clutter, that's actually when you're going to be most creative, when you're going to be able to use your senses to react appropriately to what's really happening around you, when you're going to be most in tune with nature. So, you know, that's all pretty down to earth. But moving to this more metaphysical, being is coming out of non-being as a principle of inaction of the universe. I'm not sure what to make of that other than, oh, it's so big that I could not possibly understand it. It could not be expressed.
So, see, I just actually have the Tao Te Ching in front of me, or a version of it. Can I read the first passage? Because it speaks to these points.
Oh, please do.
Kinda. All right. So, the Tao that can be expressed is not the eternal Tao. Okay, so that was the first line that we talked about earlier, right? The name that can be named is not the eternal name. Okay, again, it seems to be a reiteration of the same point. Okay, the third line is, non-existence, I call the beginning of heaven and earth. Existence, I call the mother of individual beings. Therefore does the direction towards non-existence lead to the sight of the miraculous essence, and the direction towards existence in the sight of spatial limitations. Both are one in origin and differently only in name. In its unity, it is called the secret. The secret, still deeper secret, is the gateway through which all miracles emerge. Okay, so that was the first passage of the Tao Te Ching, the most important text.
Why I did not pick that to read on? Because I have no idea what the hell that means.
Right. Okay, but one of the things I venture to say here is that when we, I mean, admittedly, this is as difficult a text as anything I've ever read anywhere by anybody. I mean, even to understand, never mind to decide whether I like it or not, or whether it's right or wrong, but it's just drenched in metaphysics. And so there's nothing really psychological and so on. I think these texts, these references to existence and non-existence, I think the only way to take these kinds of terms that they use here is really, ironically, literally, right at their word. And they mean metaphysics. These are not relativist notions, except insofar as it's impossible to really speak about these things with words, as you know, they make a point to say again and again. But the term existence is a very metaphysical notion as they use it. I mean, I think there's a mistake sometimes, you know, in contemporary Western readings, and I'm not going to include the Tao of Pooh in this, because I think that was very good, I seem to remember, but other, you know, the sort of New Age use, and you know, what Taoism means and what it's saying. And I think that they really miss the point sometimes, and it gets sort of all mucked up in sort of Western psychology. And I want to say, I don't think that that's how they meant it. And I don't think it's how Chuang Tzu means these notions and stuff. Okay. So I wanted to read that passage and sort of emphasize this point that whatever it is they're trying to say about existence and non-existence and its unity and what it means to go in the direction of these things and so on, they really mean it in a very serious kind of way.
There's the great world machine, which is God or the Tao or something, if we want to take it as a metaphysical realist. And because that's so big and cool compared to us, that is the reason why all our little scrapings and attempts to understand it, all of our philosophy as the Confucians and things were doing it, it might as well be the peeping of baby birds. And so the way that this manifests itself in our lives is as the workings of nature, right? In our own natures, our own capabilities, our place in the natural world with the bunnies and trees and things. And so the best we can do is, as he says a few times, let it be. Stop meddling with nature.
I don't wonder about that. The whole notion of Wu Wei, you know, there sort of seems to be metaphysical texts in all of this, and, you know, claims are made about the way things are. And then there's a whole different class of claims, which is methodology, like, you know, well, given that things are so and so, you know, what should we do about it, or how should we be? And the Wu Wei may be more of a latter kind of claim. And it may also come in a very significant part from the Buddhist influence that happened about the same time. Buddhism came over from India about this time, and it had a way of infusing into Taoism. And there are a lot of notions that appear, especially more in later Taoist texts, where, you know, they're very distinctly Buddhist. And Wu Wei may be one of those. I'm not certain. But
Wu Wei is in this text.
Right. But, I mean, it plays a really important role later on. I mean, it tends to get highlighted a lot. And I'm just saying that, you know, also then the way that it gets translated. For example, you know, somebody in more recent times translates this old Chinese text and then, you know, emphasizes certain notions based on their understanding of what Taoism is supposed to be meaning. It's difficult to parse these things out, and it's just maybe worth recognizing that Wu Wei may be a somewhat Buddhist notion or an aspect that was highly emphasized by later Buddhist thought.
Fish live in water and thrive, but if men tried to live in the water, they would die.
Yes. So that's the indexicality I was referring to, this relational, which sounds very much like Aristotle, right? Everything has their own excellence built into it, and we should accord with that, right? Maybe not excellence, but our nature.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd use the word excellence, but trying to make the transition from metaphysics to ethics in this text and talking about, okay, so if we assume there is such a thing as a sage or this way of heaven, and it involves inaction, which is somehow the permitting of things to occur the way they should, mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to impose your consciousness or will or intention or something on it, there's definitely a notion of fate. And that in a weird way, the sage is the one who just kind of accepts fate and lets things kind of happen the way they happen.
Right.
So when, Mark, when you sort of set this thing up on the website, you know, you talked about wisdom. So I was thinking about it in terms of wisdom, but there is kind of a problematic, or at least a concept of ethical behavior that we're going to have to work through that's a little difficult when it essentially says, don't push any boundaries, don't change anything, don't fight, don't make judgments, simply allow things to occur as they occur. And that somehow is the right way to act. And yet there's plenty of stories about people who are apparently, you know, relatively well-liked and virtuous who are dying and then being mourned.
Right.
I just had a section here on fate that I'm trying to look up and find right now.
He certainly talks about that in terms of death a lot and how it should lead to a lessening of attachment, right? Which again, sounds like this Buddhist notion. So last time we talked about Nietzsche's objection to what he thought of Eastern thought, which was Buddhism, as being, you know, the same in some ways as his objection to all religion, which is that it despises life. It's trying to escape life. That the Buddhist says, life is suffering. We should get the hell out of it. We should become one with the void and lift ourselves out of this. And sometimes it sounds like the Taoist is saying that as well, because not that life is suffering, but just that we need to get rid of attachments. He specifically says that in a number of places. So one of that means not fearing your own death and not getting too worked up when somebody close to you dies. The other side of that Nietzsche would probably approve of, that's very non-Buddhist, is that you should really enjoy what there is to enjoy. So Chuang Tzu has this notion of free and easy wandering. It's not just letting things happen. It's also kind of getting out there and experiencing and juicing life. You know, sounds like a very romantic notion, which doesn't mean go out there and try and like have big enterprises or pursue greatness in the way Nietzsche would want you to. But it's a more of a passive spectator. Get enjoyment out of life, and then when it's gone, don't worry about it.
That's interesting. I have not so well read on Nietzsche, but that seems to me a very important difference between Taoism and Buddhism. The Taoism does have that life-affirming side, that joyous side, if not conquer the world, you know, in this sense, but to live and to really live.
Can I read a couple of things here?
Yep.
This is in section 3, towards the end.
3, the secret of caring for life?
Yeah. So this is the story of Lao Tan dies, and Qin Shi goes to mourn for him. He gives 3 cries and leaves the room. And one of Lao Tzu's disciples says, "Weren't you a friend of the master?" And he says, "Yes." And he says, "You think it's all right to mourn him this way?" "Yes." He says, "At first I took him for a real man, but now I know he wasn't. A little while ago when I went in to mourn, I found old men weeping for him as though they were weeping for a son, and young men weeping for him as though they were weeping for a mother. To have gathered a group like that, he must have done something to make them talk about him, though he didn't ask them to talk, or make them weep for him, though he didn't ask them to weep. This is to hide from heaven. Turn your back on the true state of affairs and forget what you were born with. In the old days, this was called the crime of hiding from heaven." All these things have names, right? "The 3 pearls of wisdom in a cave. Your master happened to come because it was his time, and he happened to leave because things follow along. If you are content with the time and willing to follow along, then grief and joy have no way to enter in. In the old days, this was called being freed from the bonds of God." I'm interpreting that as being a good thing. The former, hiding from heaven is bad, but being freed from the bonds of God is good. That you can eliminate grief and joy simply by being content with, you know, your time and whatever's allotted to you. And that's what gets me confused, because the following section we read on perfect happiness was all about inaction. It's important to not be swayed by emotion, or to not allow grief and joy and passion in. And perfect happiness is related to inaction. And that in turn is tied with fate, because there's another story about this man whose wife dies. And then he's banging on a tub and singing or something like that.
Yeah, in a jolly way.
Yeah. And the guy says, "Don't you think," he says, "it should be enough simply not to weep at her death, but pounding on a tub and singing, this is going too far, isn't it?" And he says, "You're wrong. When she first died, do you think I didn't grieve like anyone else? But I looked back to her beginning and the time before she was born. Not only the time before she was born, but the time before she had a body. Not only the time before she had a body, but before she had a spirit. In the midst of the jumble of wonder and a mystery, and a change took place, and she had a spirit. Another change, she had a body. Another change, she was born. Now there's been another change and she's dead. It's just like the progression of the 4 seasons. Now she's going to lie down peacefully in a room. If I were to follow after her bawling and sobbing, it would show that I don't understand anything about fate. So I stopped." So that one tied together to me the themes of being and non-being, and generation from non-being to being, and also the simultaneously this sort of passive acceptance of fate and being impassive in the face of all the activities of life. But the whole purpose of that passage is to point out that death is just change, and that change is the natural state of things. And to get upset or to be angry about change is ridiculous. No?
Yes, I totally agree.
So am I a sage?
Sure, why not?
You could,
for this one moment, but it may slip out of your hands if you're not careful.
Yeah, you could say it with your words, but that doesn't mean...
Ah, yes, that's a good point. The sage who calls himself a sage is not a sage, a true sage.
There's a normativity to what's being advocated, and that normativity is founded in nature. The way things naturally happen is the good way. And the only real badness out there, and the only thing that we should avoid, is to compete with that natural way. It seems to me that underlying all of Taoist ethics is this basic notion.
Now, this going along with nature yourself, this confuses me because, I mean, does this, that sounds to me in some ways like, don't try so hard, do what is natural for you. But in other places, he specifically talks about mastering yourself. So this is near the beginning of section 7, bit 4, emperors and kings. When the sage governs, does he govern what is on the outside? He makes sure of himself first, and then he acts. He makes absolutely certain that things can do what they are supposed to do. That is all. The bird flies high in the sky where it can escape the danger of stringed arrows. The field mouse burrows deep down under the sacred hill where it won't have to worry about men digging and smoking it out. Have you got less sense than these two little creatures? So it's sort of, that sounds like you just have to pay attention to your own capabilities, and that's what following nature is, right? But then somewhere else, I remember he talks about fasting. This is the woodworker Ching. It's in the section Mastering Life. So this guy is really good at carving wood, and somebody asked him about his methods. He says, I'm only a craftsman. How would I have any art? There's one thing, however, when I'm going to make a bell stand, I never let it wear out my energy. I always fast in order to still my mind. When I have fasted for 3 days, I no longer have any thoughts of congratulations or rewards or titles or stipends. When I fasted for 5 days, I no longer have any thought of praise or blame, of skill or clumsiness. When I fasted for 7 days, I'm so still that I forget that I have four limbs and a form and body. By that time, the ruler and his court no longer exist for me. My skill is concentrated and all outside distractions fade away.
There is a section there about the cook, which I think makes the same point. Cook Ting was cutting up an ox for Lord Wen Hu. At every touch of his hand, every heave of his shoulder, every move of his feet, every thrust of his knee, zip-zoop, he slithered the knife along, and with a zing and all was in perfect rhythm, as though he were performing the dance of the mulberry grove or keeping time to the Qing Shao music. All this is marvelous. Imagine skill reaching such heights. Cook Ting laid down his knife and replied, "What I care about is the way, which goes beyond skill. When I first began cutting up oxen, all I could see was the ox. After 3 years, I no longer saw the whole ox. And now I go at it by spirit and don't look with my eyes. Perception and understanding have come to a stop, and spirit moves where it wants. I go along with the natural makeup, strike in the big hollows, guide the knife through the big openings, and follow things as they are. So I never touch the smallest ligament or tendon, much less a main joint."
Sure. I guess the difference between those two is if you think that what you have to do these great things involves fasting, for instance, that's really doesn't seem to be paying attention to your nature and what your inner voice is asking you to do. That seems like, right, like all forms of asceticism, of denying your inner nature. So, you know, I see both of these kind of things. One is, you know, listen carefully to the way your body works and, you know, follow that. And that's the way you could develop great athletic skill, for instance. But then it's also this, you know, ultimately mastering yourself in the way of a monk. If you say I'm mastering myself, but yet I'm following the way of nature, that seems to me that you have some bad ideas about psychology and you're trying to conform yourself to those as opposed to actually doing what your nature is telling you. Maybe the problem I have is that I don't think, other than you should eat when you're hungry and you should sleep when you're tired, I don't think nature tells you enough. It underdetermines how you should act. So I'm much more in agreement with the existentialists that there is no built-in nature that we have to achieve, that we are forced to make choices.
I think this forgetting this asceticism, though, is consistent with this idea of nature. This sense of losing, no longer have any thought of congratulations or rewards or titles or stipends. There's the withdrawal from the social and then from the body and so on and so forth. And then you get to, my skill is concentrated and all outside distractions fade away. Despite the forgetting of the body, there's the sense of, I don't know how you describe that. And then after that, I go into the mountain forest and examine the heavenly nature of the trees. So I think, you know, you get the loss of the, at least the bodily self, but you're sort of immersed, I guess, in nature, and the idea of nature is something encompassing and outside. This doesn't go towards your existentialism point, but I don't see the asceticism as necessarily inconsistent with this idea of nature, even though Nietzsche, of course, thinks of it, asceticism as anti-nature. But
I wonder if I could throw this out there, something out there on one of these points in terms of this friction or this duality or dichotomy of asceticism and hedonism, I suppose, almost. I mean, bear in mind that, like, in the larger context, that there's one thing to sort of discuss what are the ultimate truths of things and what are the foundations upon which everything is built, including ethics and the rest. And it's another to be a person who tries to become this true man or an immortal or whatever. And once you're in that sort of second category, then you're in the realm of methods. And then when you get into methods, then all bets are off with nature, because the assumption is maybe that you're, you know, implicitly corrupted by society. And so your return to nature is necessarily going to be require a certain, you know, kind of aggressive act that you, you know, fast and that you do these things. And I mean, this is also a time, you know, when things got rough politically at this point, you know, you had all these monasteries and so on all of a sudden start to develop martial arts. And from what I've read, I mean, being a Taoist monk was no picnic. I mean, it was really tough. And the kinds of trainings that you did were really, really, really tough. Anyway, so I just wanted to put some kind of context there, though, that, you know, it's apples and oranges in terms of talking about sort of the way that one what one aspires to be as opposed to how one actually works oneself to achieve that in a way. So I don't see there being such a friction between these notions.
Okay, well, I guess I can see. Here's another way, just to connect it back to the mysticism thing. So my initial analysis of this, I wrote what was a kind of central paper for me in my freshman year or something of college, and then I ended up expanding this and taking it a different direction to make it my undergrad thesis, which was the idea that people's identities are fluid. That is, I can identify myself as just this one, you know, a point that stands above my body and stands above even my past. Like, you can restrict your sense of self to something very narrow. So Hume is a guy who talks like this sometimes, or in existentialists, when they talk about radical freedom, that's what they're talking about to some extent. Or you could to have a more ordinary sense of self that, you know, that includes my body. So if you step on my foot, you're hurting me. You're not just hurting my foot, you're hurting me. And mystics enlarge the sense of self to include something outside. So in some ways, what you're doing in getting yourself in touch with nature in the way that Chuang Tzu is recommending is you're identifying yourself not as this little fleeting being that is born and then dies, but with this larger system of nature. And, you know, that the extreme is the mystical experience where you are having an immediate understanding of yourself as part of, as identical with the whole of creation. And, you know, somebody like Nietzsche, I think, is going to say that these larger forms of identification are delusional. That in some ways that, you know, what you are, what you can't escape being, is these passions, these drives, this will to power. And to try to identify yourself with some larger thing is, in fact, to deny life, is to deny your individual life. But that's, you know, the exact kind of thing that Chuang Tzu and the other mystics are doing, or, you know, whether it's even Western mystics, like identifying yourself with God's plan, subverting the individual. And that's, you know, they think that's all healthy, even if that means fasting and doing things that might seem destructive to the individual, what you might in other circumstances consider yourself.
It's strange because it's the sage. It's hard to tell if the sage is Übermensch or ascetic priest, you know. We're going to bring in Nietzsche. I think there are overman qualities as well.
I don't know, man.
You know, so for instance, martial arts and this concentration on doing and parables of, say, the butcher and so on and so forth, I think that is not quite the ascetic priest that Nietzsche had in mind. So there's this some sort of retreat, but then there are these, you know, these men are supposed to be kick-ass in some way.
Well, if you're identifying with the flow of nature, I mean, that sounds like ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus that Nietzsche very much liked, that, you know, the only reality is ultimately change. And so if you're the system of cycle of death and rebirth, of being and non-being, and that's what the making things equal is about. It's about getting away from these individual distinctions and perspectives and seeing that the reality is this whole in some way. Whether you interpret it as an unchanging whole in the way of Parmenides or a changing whole in the way of Heraclitus, I don't think it matters for these guys. Drop all over the fucking place.
Yeah, I was going to throw the flag on that one. That was like an orgy of name dropping.
But I explained what I mean.
Explain yourself.
That is, do you think of being underlying as this eternal, you know, unchanging in any important respect thing, which is what the Parmenides position, which is what Plato goes after. And really, you know, we shouldn't trust the senses and trust these momentary things. We need to get in touch with the eternal. And that's exactly the kind of thing that Nietzsche hates. Or is it what is reality is the constantly changing, you know, the constants of substance of eternity is all just mythical distraction from the mesh of life. So Chuang Tzu sort of sounds like one, and sometimes he sounds like the other to me.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you were going to press me to pick one or the other, I'd choose the latter.
The Heraclitus, that it's the constant change in motion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd say that, I mean, in a way, the I Ching, the Book of Changes, is a very foundational text for Taoist thinking, and they were all using it at the time and reading from that. And I think that that is much closer to the heart of Taoism than the Parmenidian view of a static ultimate. I also would concur there a lot.
Can you just explain a little? The I Ching was like a divining tool, right? It's a book that... Explain a little more what you mean.
It was and it is used as a divining tool, but I think that like all things like this, you know, its roots are, it was a text, and it was a text that was read in a variety of ways. One of them was through divining, but it's a really old text. I think like that text goes 1,000 years before Chuang Tzu. So it's just way in the horizons, the beginning of time that this was used. But throughout a lot of, you know, Lao Tzu, and I didn't actually see a reference in Chuang Tzu, but I'm sure he must reference it somewhere. But it's referenced all over the place as a sort of an ultimate foundational text of wisdom of how to be in a variety of contexts. And its tone is itself very Taoist. It's not Confucian and so rigid to various kinds of traditions and so on. It speaks in the same kinds of parables. It's a collection of parables, I think 64 texts that are compiled into a book. And each one of them is a little wisdom story that would be appropriate for a certain kind of context. But the fundamental notion behind it is that the universe or the cosmos or the world is in a state of flux, mm-hmm. like Heraclitus said. And it's not just any old random flux. I mean, there is measure to the way the flux happens. And if you can attune yourself to that measure of when things are up or down or bright or dark or whatever, then you can use that knowledge to respond in a most wise way to achieve the most or the best out of the situation. Does that say it?
Let me give a contrasting passage. And some of this was the footnote that you don't have. But back in the Chapter 2, discussing of making all things equal, there's a part that starts, "There is such a thing as completion and injury." Mr. Chow playing the lute is an example. "There is such a thing as no completion and no injury." Mr. Chow not playing the lute is an example. Chow Wen played the lute. Music master Quang waved his baton. Hui Tzu leaned on his desk. The knowledge of all these was close to perfection. All were mastered, and therefore their names have been handed down. What they liked, they tried to make clear. What he is not clear about, they tried to make clear. And so they ended in the foolishness of hard and white. Okay, now that seemed like a completely impenetrable passage to me. But the footnote says, Chao Wen was a famous lute player, but the best music he could play, that is, complete, was only a pale and partial reflection of the ideal music, which was thereby injured and impaired, just as the unity of the way was injured and impaired by the appearance of love, i.e. man's likes and dislikes. Hence, when Mr. Chao refrained from playing the lute, there was neither completion nor injury. It sounds very much like Plato or Parmenides, that there's the ideal world, and by existing at all, and certainly by speaking, by making these distinctions, we're creating chaos, whereas if we would stop this and just get back in touch with nature, be more like an animal, then what you have is perfect harmony, perfect unity. That, strangely enough, for, you mentioned, Seth, that passage of the guy singing during the funeral. No, it seems like if this was a life-affirming, joyous philosophy, like singing should be an essential part of it. You know, singing, it's got rhythm. You can put yourself in what seems like a natural rhythm. Like, you know, music is very much amenable. You could imagine, you know, there's Taoist kind of music. But Chuang Tzu specifically says in a number of parts here, like compares music to all the other kinds of things that the Confucians were doing, that like creating these elegant forms, breaking the spectrum of all possible notes into the six tones, or however he puts it, is doing damage to the great unified mass that is nature and existence before we stupid bastards come along and screw it up. So one of the things you need to get rid of is music, because it's only an imperfect copy of nature. Maybe for the reason that we've already said several times, there isn't really a distinction between the ultimate existence as constant change and the ultimate existence as constant unchanging harmony, because the ultimate existence is something that we can't talk about, right? So it's the same. It's neither and both of those. Is that a good cop-out answer?
Yeah, I think you're doing well on the cop-out answer there. Yeah, I'll go with you on that.
Yeah, I guess the question that begs to be asked then is, what's the point? So let's say for the sake of argument that we understand. We don't understand, but we get it. The way that can be spoken of is not the true way, and that there are all these different things we've talked about, accepting fate, inaction, understanding that all things are changeable and come from nothing and return to nothing, that at some point you're going to get it and you're going to see the way. So what? If you don't become that sage that Wes is talking about, if you don't become this perfect man with all these superpowers, if you just become the perfect man that, like the drunk guy in the carriage, just doesn't get hurt because he's too drunk to know he's actually riding in a car.
Right. It's a guy throws himself out of the side of a carriage, but yet does not get hurt because he's drunk. Right? Isn't that the way the example goes?
Yeah, yeah. It says, when a drunken man falls from a carriage, though the carriage may be going very fast, he won't be killed. He has bones and joints, and yet he is not injured as normal men would be because his spirit is whole. How is it whole? He didn't know he was riding, and he doesn't know that he's falling out. So, apparently...
This is true, by the way.
Wes can tell you. They still
in fact, if your best bet for surviving a high fall, people have survived really high falls, it's to be drunk, because basically the more relaxed you are when you hit the ground, the better off you are.
Your muscles are not going to tense up and make your bones in a way that it will break.
It's absolutely
I'm not
true.
Sure that's the point that he's trying to make.
Well it's the man of, yeah, no, because he's serene. No, he's serene.
Yes, exactly. He says, life and death, alarm and terror do not enter his breast, so he can bang against things without fear of injury. If he can keep himself whole like this by means of wine, how much more can he keep himself whole by means of heaven?
And crack.
The sage hides himself in heaven, and hence there is nothing that can do him harm.
PCP.
Well, you know, no, it's that inner serenity, you know, settling of the spirit, complete inner peace.
Much like the Terminator.
What?
The cops, in explaining why the Terminator could smash through the windshield and grab at people and not be hurt, is, oh, he must have been on a lot of PCP. And yeah. And so I'm just really stretching a metaphor here.
Boy, you really are.
Just be. I think we should just be like the Terminator. I think that's how do we know that loving life is not a delusion? If you don't think about that, you just think about doing your job, just terminating.
That's,
don't focus on self-preservation.
I guess that's true.
I don't know. That doesn't sound right to me at all. And PCP, the metaphor breaks. I mean, it's a very tense thing. You know?
Thank you for taking my bullshit seriously enough to respond to it. Hey, I want to return just a second here to, you know, Wes, I think you let that skepticism thing drop a little too quickly, because we have a couple passages here still in the discussion on making all things equal that are classic skepticism, both toward the end, one of which is just, again, talking about the death thing. How do I know that loving life is not a delusion? How do I know that in hating death, I am not like a man who, having left home in my youth, has forgotten the way back? So something that, for Nietzsche, for instance, is a primary and unquestionable, this love of life, this will to power, is, that's questionable too. Why should you prefer, which this sounds... I don't like to keep making these comparisons and name dropping, but this sounds like Socrates in the Apology. Like, how do we know death is bad? We just don't. We've never been there. Like, we might as well go along right with fate, like you were saying, Seth. And so, you know, a skepticism gives rise to a serenity that our inability to understand the existence means we should just be okay with it, however it happens to be. Because the fundamental reason for doing philosophy is, like, you figure out what you can know. Figure out what is out there insofar as you can know it, and then you act accordingly. But if you get rid of that model, like, no, we can't know. We just should act, just pretty much do nothing or do what comes naturally.
Yeah.
That's just over-intellectualizing
that
your life.
That was a big part of the skeptical tradition. It was actually revived with Descartes.
The next part is exactly from Descartes.
Well, Sextus Empiricus, who's another ancient skeptic, there's a lot in there about basically doing nothing because you don't know. It sort of leads to inaction. You see some of that here, right? I don't know if you would call it inaction, but it leads to a type of detachment from the world, let's say.
I think you have earned the right, Wes, to read the last paragraph of the discussion on making all things equal chapter. It's the skeptical one.
Once Chuang Chao dreamt he was a butterfly flitting and fluttering around, happy with himself and doing as he pleased. He didn't know he was Chuang Chao. Suddenly he woke up and there he was, solid and unmistakable Chuang Chao. He didn't know if he was Chuang Chao who had dreamt he was a butterfly, or a butterfly dreaming he was Chuang Chao. Between Chuang Chao and a butterfly, there must be some distinction. This is called the transformation of things.
What do you think? I mean, is that a presentation of the classic skeptical position or something weirder?
Both.
Yeah.
It sounded like the skeptical position until this is called the transformation of things, which sounds more like that, again, everything exists in its opposite or something, or ultimately all these distinctions that we as perceivers make.
Yeah.
Yeah, like we're imposing all these distinctions just by perceiving things, by being finite. This sounds like Leibniz, to name drop one more time, that we are a specific perspective point in space, and so we have a certain point of view, but if we could just get beyond that to the God point of view, again, maybe this is through a mystical experience, then we would see that the distinction is crap, illusory. Is that...
Well, you know what, though? Yeah, I want to jump on one of your words. Illusory. I got troubled with this word used in the Taoist context. Maybe it's also in reference to this notion of skepticism. The Taoists didn't hype on about illusion so much. That's a really Buddhist notion. Mm. It has all kinds of connotations with it. I don't think they mean. It's true that being a butterfly isn't the whole truth, and it's true that being a man isn't the whole truth, but they are still some kind of truth. I mean, it's not nothing. It's not.
Sure.
And again, this sometimes plays back to sort of, even if life and everything we live is completely a dream and an illusion, it's still one that is worth doing well and being a really good, you know, carver of ox or whatever. That notion of illusion, I just would treat it really softly in the Taoist context. I don't think it fits.
Whether you're okay with the word illusion or not would correspond exactly to that metaphysical point between Parmenides and Heraclitus I was just contemplating. That if you think that reality is this unchanging Parmenidean whole, like the Buddhists do, then the things of the everyday are illusory, and you should just dismiss them and try to attain mystical oneness with the void. And sometimes I read Taoism in the same way. But if you're saying, no, they're not truth with a capital T, but they are truths from a perspective, and that's just fine for most purposes, then that sounds a little more like Nietzsche, like Heraclitus, like these other folks, which it seems like a more... To me, maybe as a Nietzschean-influenced person, a more healthy attitude than simply denying the reality of all this through an extreme skepticism.
Maybe it does play out that way. I mean, Buddhism is to Taoism as Parmenides is to Heraclitus. Maybe that works.
Any other points we especially want to hit on in the text that we haven't hit yet? I mean, there's this elitism that we've referred to a little bit. So like looking at the end of the Mastering Life chapter, I'm not going to read this whole thing, but a guy approaches a sage, Master Pien Ching Tzu, and the sage tells him what the Tao is all about a little bit. And then he goes away, and one of his disciples asks, "Why does my teacher sigh?" Master Pien said, "Just now, Sun Tzu came to see me, and I described him the virtue of the perfect man. I'm afraid that he was very startled. It may end up in a complete muddle." It's like, oh, surely not. Was what Master Sun said right and what my teacher said wrong? If so, then wrong can certainly never make a muddle out of right. Or was what Master Sun said wrong and what my teacher said right? If so, then he must have already been in a muddle when he came here, so what's the harm? That whole paragraph sounds like very much like something Socrates would say, and like, you know, the worse can never harm the better or something like that. But Master Pien says, "You don't understand. Once long ago, a bird alighted in the suburbs of the Liu capital." It's like a crazy old uncle going off with
a... Let me guess. They're going to try to feed the bird some human food and it's not going to like it.
Yes! They fed the bird some human food. It was unhappy and dazed. It did not dare to eat or drink. This is what is called trying to nourish a bird with what would nourish you. If you want to nourish a bird with what will nourish a bird, you best let it roost in the deep forest, blah, blah, blah. Now, Sun Tzu is a man of ignorance and little learning. For me to describe him the virtue of the perfect man is like taking a mouse for a ride in a carriage, or trying to delight a quail with the music of bells and drums. How could he help but be startled? So, I'm only talking to the sages. Only the sages should read this book, because the rest of you will just be confused. You'll interpret the great virtue as being like these shitty little virtues that the Confucians put forward, and you'll try to conform your life with the life of the sage, which is exactly what you're not supposed to do. And so it ends up being very frustrating if you're just approaching it as a how-to-live-your-life guide.
In some of the commentary I was reading, and by the way, usually Wikipedia is a good source for like Western philosophy. It's really weak on this stuff, by the way, is that the Tao or the way is not a transcendent notion, or I should say, it is not intended to be transcendent. It's not overarching. It's
not outside of actual experience.
It's not outside of actual experience, correct. But in the same way that these Zen teachings are supposed to kind of shock you out of your regular understanding of consciousness into some kind of enlightenment, is that kind of what this text might be aiming at? Is we're using words which we know ultimately are not going to describe. You're not going to read anything in here that's going to tell you. I guess perhaps you could be led or guided in some way, shape, or fashion to a realization or an awareness. Or is it more getting to that state is going to take months and months and years and years, and you have to undertake some kind of meditation or rigorous study to get to the place where you become a sage and you learn the way?
Well, he says some people have the talent for being a sage and some don't, which is not to deny what you're saying. It's just that some people, even if you do study like that, you're not going to get that.
But it looks like it requires some work.
Maybe
it's different for all different sorts. If you're a little bear that likes honey, maybe it comes really naturally and easily. But, you know, one thing, just a note on the Zen, as we referenced it a few times. I mean, Zen Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, came from China. And Buddhism, when it first came to China, went through a dramatic transformation when it went to China. And the major split in Buddhism to exist today between Mahayana and, Hinayana, corresponds there exactly. So that Chinese Buddhism and Japanese Buddhism and Korean Buddhism are all of this form Mahayana, whereas the Buddhism that's in other parts of the world and Southeast is Hinayana, or in India. And the reason I say this is because this is something I did a little bit of work on at one point, is that in following the way that Buddhism did change in its thinking, it was profoundly influenced by Taoism. Zen is sort of an extreme form of Mahayana Buddhism, and this notion of using words to achieve a certain effect, I think very much does come exactly from Taoism, really, more than anything else. This recognition that the limitations of language and what you can do with it philosophically, and that instead we use it in a different way to create an effect in our consciousness to achieve a satori or enlightenment or whatever like.
I mean, I guess that's the comment I was making earlier in asking whether there's the idea of mystical experience in here, because now that you're mentioning this, I'm remembering the Zen text that I remember. It was all like, one guy says to the other guy, what's the sound of one hand clapping? And the second guy thinks about it and is enlightened. that's right. The way the texts are written, like that, the first guy bats the second guy in the head with a book in an answer to the same question, and enlightenment occurs. Like, an enlightenment is this very like physical satori experience where they just don't mention that in here. Instead, it's more, again, like those examples of, you know, having to go through these extensive regimens of trying to forget the crummy things that culture has taught you and to empty your mind, and then you become gradually more in touch with the way. It's not that just, bing, I'm enlightened. There's the way. I don't know if there's enlightenment in this sense.
My question isn't how quickly it comes. My question is there a concept of enlightenment that is inherent in this, and that, you know, we're being told all these stories and these little things about fish and beautiful women and monkeys and so on, because we're supposed to be led to a realization that we quote unquote see with, I don't know, is it our, I guess there's a place in here where it says, in I think section 19, where it talks about knowing what knowledge can't actually get to or something like that. There's a concept of getting to some form of understanding, which is not traditional knowledge, which is not knowledge in the categorical sense that we understand it, that you could articulate. It's an awareness of something. And in that sense, I guess, is what I'm thinking of when I use the term enlightenment.
There's two comments. I mean, the one is just that this notion of enlightenment is definitely in Taoism. I mean, the different terms for it, illumination and other terms used maybe, but no question that this notion of a very metaphysical transformation can happen that allows you to have access to extraordinary power and knowledge. But I just want to sort of throw this in at the same time that even in Zen, this notion of enlightenment is really abused. What I want to avoid is looking at Taoism as built on a normativity of trying to achieve this, because even the Zen people say this, that you build up too much around this notion of enlightenment and you'd sort of totally miss the point. I mean, you have to really treat this concept of enlightenment really delicately, I think, in a way, or you really will make a muddle.
If you're trying to be enlightened, you will certainly not be enlightened.
I don't even know if that's so, but maybe, yeah, something like that.
Well, there's some places in the Chuang Tzu where he talks about, you know, somebody else in the story is talking to as a sage, but then, you know, is already respected as a Taoist sage, but then, oh, they discover that somebody else has way more insight into Taoism. So it's not like enlightenment is a one-dimensional thing. You're either enlightened or you're not enlightened, which seems maybe the case with Zen, I'm not sure. There's sort of always room for vast improvement.
Well, I mean, this is actually one of the points that gets disputed a lot amongst Buddhists of various schools is what is it and how much of it is it and how much can you get of it and stuff like that. And that is actually a major difference in the two big schools I mentioned before. The Hinayana one says, yeah, there is an enlightenment, basically.
The Indian?
And the Mahayana one, that's right. Yeah. And the Mahayana one that was influenced by Taoism says, no, it's more subtle than that. It's sort of, yes, there is, but there's not just one enlightenment, maybe, and you know, it's all a lot more fluid than that and more complex or something like that.
Right. Well, then the skepticism is definitely involved, and there's, you know, consequently political implications that, you know, you hear of Buddhist societies and the leaders of Buddhist societies. Maybe I'm just kind of talking out of my ass here, but you could, in the same way, proclaim sort of the divine right of kings, like, oh, we're the enlightened, we should be the rulers, like that you could do something like that, where Taoism just doesn't admit of that at all. There's no sense in which the sages then, first of all, the sages aren't supposed to rule, that ruling is bad, getting involved in political affairs is bad, but it's not so clear who's enlightened and not enlightened, right? It's just there's not the potential of abuse in the way, it seems, at least. I don't know, on the other hand, there's some very arrogant talk in here of some of the characters in here that are supposed to be in the know about Taoism, just condemning and dissing all this bullshit that other people who seem to think themselves are respected or, you know, have something going for them. So it is used as a weapon in this way, at least in the sense of being elitist.
The divine right of kings, I mean, that really is there. I mean, the emperor is supposed to be sort of the son of heaven. And I mean, I don't think it's just Taoist, but I think, you know, throughout all of the different schools, you know, emperor was emperor by virtue of it being somehow bestowed by something greater than humanity.
But you think that's, sure that's in Taoism? That
no,
seems
no,
like Taoism
big,
would explicitly reject
no, no,
that.
No, 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 okay. No, no. I'm saying it's bigger than Taoism. I mean, it was something that all of the schools accepted. I don't think there was any challenge to that particularly. If anybody did challenge it, I suppose it would be the Taoists. But I mean, still the Taoists, like throughout the I Ching and throughout the Tao of Politics, this third text that comes a couple hundred years later, I mean, when they do engage with the political, I mean, they do speak in terms of the notion of a good ruler and a good ruler succeeding and how they succeed, and that these successes, you know, are dependent upon appreciating the way the Tao works. And that it is natural for there to be an emperor and for there to be servants and a minister. I mean, this notion of sort of emperor, prince, minister, and servant, you know, is completely written into sort of the fabric of the metaphors that they're using all over the place. And these are natural. I mean, maybe it's not divinely bestowed in the sort of sense of a personalized God, but it is bestowed by the Tao, so to speak, because it's the natural order of things.
Mm.
So all that's in there. Yeah, I don't think that they were prototype Democrats or something like that.
Let's just go around and sort of give closing thoughts, things that we have not yet said. I mean, what's your reaction to this? Do you think it's a load of crap?
I like it, but I don't know. Is it asserting enough to be a load of crap or not a load of crap?
It's well, you are all like
depends on your perspective.
You
fish says
you have in other
to the fish, it is a load of crap.
In other podcasts, you have expressed that, you know, this emphasis on utility, on how knowledge is useful. which seems to be a primary thing, you know, from the pragmatist through maybe Nietzsche or, you know, anybody who's not searching truth for truth's sake, that it becomes, how can I use this truth? And I would think that you would be very amenable to this specific rejection of this, the notion of utility in any form.
Yeah, I dislike any usefulness. Utility's bad.
You're the Kantian, right, Wes? Did I get that right?
Well, I'm a skeptic. I call myself a zetetic skeptic.
Zetetic.
Meaning seeking the truth, but knowing that it's not possible to fully obtain it. There's some insights in Kant that I like. Yeah, ethically, I mean, and I wouldn't call myself a Kantian ethically, but I mean, I'm probably closer to Aristotle or Nietzsche. I don't know. I just, this is more poetic to me, and I like the overall feeling of it. It could be something very personal, but it's just the style of parables and the mixture of, you know, I don't know. But as far as as guidance on living, given my instinct to laziness, I think the idea of inactivity is always very appealing. So there's a lot here that appeals to me.
In fact, I'll second that as my sort of closing, that the way I reacted to this, and I didn't see this in this text, but another one of these, maybe it's from the Tao Te Ching, but just that there's an overall sense that whenever somebody presents, and this is how it fed into my life when I discovered it in undergrad, was whenever somebody puts a standard in front of you and says, you know, if you don't jump through these hoops, then you're not going to succeed according to the standard, then it is my instinct and it is the explicit directive of Taoism to say, screw your standard.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, just like the laziness thing, I can see that as just a bad psychological game that one plays with oneself. You can't fail if you don't try. And so taking the Homer Simpson version of that is, don't try.
Yeah.
I wonder if Homer Simpson isn't actually a sort of a cloaked Taoist there. That's an interesting.
But I, you know, I like the other thing here is I do, despite the Nietzsche thing, I guess I have mixed feelings. I think I'm not an ascetic, obviously, but the whole retreat into the life of the mind thing, I have no qualms about that. Although I'm not sure, in this case, I think it's something different. Because on the one hand, there's the retreat, but on the other hand, I don't think it's a retreat to the kind of contemplative life that, say, Plato and Aristotle were talking about. In the sense of,
that's too much analysis.
Yeah. So maybe I haven't gotten lazy enough, let's say, because the mind keeps churning. But
yeah. Isn't it even part of it that the way you could be lazy is by sort of just being satisfied doing your menial job?
Yeah, which horrifies me.
Yeah.
Like, actually, my favorite part of the reading was the description of butchering the ox, the way the knife was finding all the easiest parts to cut through by missing ligaments and missing bones and hitting everything at the joints. Which, by the way, reminds me of a Platonic metaphor where basically philosophy involves finding the natural joints of things and sort of cutting things up along those lines.
Smoking those joints.
Yeah. At the same time, I had two reactions to that. So I like the sort of concept of ease there, the idea that this guy is sort of cutting through an ox like it's butter. And then on the other hand, I had this horrifying thought, my God, what if I lived back then and I actually had to do that all day? So.
Yeah, I'm not down with the no technology, no progress thing that Taoism is in favor of. Like, there's some parts I was looking through some of the sections that, again, we were not assigned, and where somebody is talking about, oh, we have this new machine that can help you do your crops faster or something, and the guy is horrified. It's that Chang Tzu is a Luddite. No, that would get me away from the personal connection with work and stuff by making a machine to do something faster. Oh no.
Yeah, and I've tried the whole return to nature / honest work, Walden Pond. I even listened to Walden Pond on a CD while driving up to Maine to go to the wooden boat building thing, the carpenter's boat shop. And working in freezing weather, doing a really difficult, not just a typical carpentry job, but all kinds of intricate stuff with wood where your mind and your body is totally focus. There's no daydreaming about other stuff when you're trying to do, like, very precise chiseling. That was hellish for me. The experience as a whole was wonderful, but the actual work, I do not have fond memories of it. Yeah, if I'd done it for long enough, maybe it would be like cutting the ox. But sitting in my easy chair and thinking,
well,
where,
is, Wes, yeah. What did you think about the passage about the old tree and its virtue? Did you catch that passage?
That was in section one that we didn't read.
Oh, that was in one, was it?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was thinking of the tree sprouting out of... Is there one where a tree sprouts out of someone's arm? Anyway.
A footnote said that he was referring to a tumor instead of a tree.
Uh-huh. Well, I like the tree because then it's... and then his friend asks him, you know... Well, first of all, he has a look of irritation, and then his friend asks him if you resent it. He's like, you know, dude, why would I resent it? Pass me the bong. That's my second favorite parable.
Just to add on to that, I mean, the practical matter of this making all things equal, so the New Agey interpretation of it, which again, I tried to really sort of live for a little while, is just be happy with however things that are happening. Just accept the bad with the good. So if you're walking around and you're kind of chilly, you should kind of just think about how alive that makes you feel and stuff. And like, I can do that kind of shit for short periods, but then it's just irritating. It's just, it's bullshit.
Have you ever become irritated at your own attempts at being cheerful?
Yes.
Like, what an asshole I am. What a fake I am.
What do you think, Seth? Do you have any closing remarks?
Well, I guess maybe from some nostalgia in childhood, I have kind of a romantic association with the metaphysical aspect of this about breathing deep and being one with the universe and understanding non-being and being. And, you know, I just, of course, like I said, I know I name drop Heidegger all the time, but I just saw a lot of that in here. What I couldn't really get in tune with was the stuff about sages and kind of action and the perfect man. But that's not an unusual problem to have, where you have some concept of knowledge or enlightenment that can't be spoken, said, or shown, but when you get it, you'll know, and then you'll know what to do. I mean, you kind of have to just sort of take it on faith, right, and say, well, you know, I guess it becomes clear what the right action is or what the good life is once you reach that state. And so even though that doesn't resonate with me, the idea that you can reach this sort of not transcendent, but almost immanent communion with the world, I still find very attractive. And doing sort of things like hypnosis and deep breathing and whatever, where you get focused on a single thing and you sort of lose track of all the rest of the things in the world, I find to be very calming and peaceful and powerful. So this notion that if you can sort of get in tune with and calm your spirit, you gain a kind of strength like the drunk man in the carriage is intriguing to me. That being said, again, I'll reiterate, for a text that's written in such a colloquial manner, it is very difficult. And this was a very, very challenging reading to just kind of come into in the middle. So thanks to Eric for coming on board with us and giving us some perspective and then a little bit of historical context now and then as needed.
You are not useless like the withered tree, Eric.
I aspire. laziness, yeah. I wonder, I think Seth is right. I mean, I think one thing, it is very difficult to take not just a text like this, but just a part of a text like this and to try and work with this and really bring out its flavors and qualities. And, you know, I mean, all of us, I guess, got a reasonably substantive foundation at University of Texas, yay, but not in Eastern philosophy. And the divide between Chinese philosophy and Western philosophy is much greater than the divide, say, between Indian philosophy and Western philosophy. And that means that, you know, I mean, it's a bit like, you know, we're a bunch of preschoolers in a way, sort of just sort of walking into reading our first book here. So it's extremely difficult, I feel like, to really do this kind of philosophy justice in such short form. I feel utterly inadequate to the task.
No, we have definitely covered this text, and no one listening to this need ever read anything else about this. You know everything now.
But having said that, there's something it does seem to want to give you that a lot of Western philosophy doesn't hand up so readily. And there's something to take. There are messages, many things to take from this, to ponder and to find the wisdom of and incorporate into one's life. It seems incredibly rich and really worthwhile. You know, like maybe one of the, if not Chuang Tzu, then maybe the Tao Te Ching is, you know, one of the 100 texts, you know, the 100 texts that have been written ever by anybody, kind of thing. I mean, somehow really important. That's would be something like my takeaway from this.
Well, thanks, everybody. Interesting voyage into this area. We're interested in hearing listener feedback, whether you would like us to do more Eastern stuff. We're open to suggestion. Next time, we're going to also be a little off of the historically important philosopher track, looking at that from a purely Western perspective. You know, we've did Kant and Nietzsche and Descartes, some of the other biggies like that. We're going to do Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg, known for the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. He wrote a book called Philosophy and Physics. And seeing that there was an actual philosophy book by a world-famous scientist, I was very curious and took a look at this. And I've read the whole thing now. It's pretty awesome. He knows his philosophy, and he talks about Heraclitus and Parmenides, and he talks about Kant, as well as telling us about quantum mechanics and the theory of relativity. And so really, the point of this for next time is to focus on the philosophical implications of quantum mechanics in our view of reality based on these, that we have maybe this intuitive, experiential conception of reality as the objects of our experience, of matter, of objects being persistent, of space and time being more or less as we perceive them. But in the earliest 20th century, we had these discoveries that supposedly throw that for a loop, depending on what kind of philosophical analysis you give of the scientific and mathematical data. So that's what we're going to talk about, and we will have an actual ex-particle physicist who is now a teacher of philosophy, among other things, my brother-in-law Dylan Casey, to guide us through some of the trickier areas on that. So we hope to see you all next time. Until then, check out partiallyexaminedlife.com, participate in some online discussions, let us know what you thought of this discussion of whether we should have other guests or whether it was just terrible for us to allow Eric into our little circle here.
oh, no. Am I the first guest?
Yes,
guess I am, aren't I?
You are super special, and we're honored to have you. So, yeah, thanks, everybody. So long from me, at least.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you all very much for having me on.
Thanks. It was great having you.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks for getting up at the mid-dead of night.
Yeah. All right. What time is it now? Oh, it's a little bird peeping. Must be the morning.
Poke an eye in your heart and start to look around. Now you're living an art, it's a start, you're a part of what's around. And you sit and you dream, and you think how it seems to mean most everything. And you're looking around, and you're seeing the sounds of love and life, and you'll be everything. As you pass time in Corporeal, feeling all you can feel. And you're looking around, and you're seeing the sounds of love and life, and you'll be everything. As you pass time in Corporeal, floating yet stable, I feel quite unable to fully depict the blurring of vision as outlines conflict, devolving, uplifting of forms that seem shifting, just images, fairy tales lived through some time ago. Now I feel I could go dancing through days that just hurt me before, but they don't anymore, 'cause I'm free. Mm-hmm. Now get up and go out, it's about your travels there. Pick a life and a love, look above, it's enough to hold you there. And if you're still feeling free, you'll be able to see that you're right where you want to be. And if it doesn't work out, you can get up and go out, look about, shed your doubt, and set out on a fresh journey. As you pass time in Corberion, feeling all you can feel, but it won't come to that. If you know where you're at, follow that which makes you be, which makes you me, which makes us free.